The idea is called squatting, taking up residency in a vacant structure without the owner's permission. And some say it is the answer to ending the housing crisis and ending homelessness.
I don't have any money saved.
So you literally gonna be out here on the street?
That's what they say.
Not if we can help it. People are finding it hard to find work in this country. If you cannot find work, you cannot maintain an income. If you cannot maintain an income, you cannot pay rent. Should the punishment be homelessness? We don't think so. So we as residents of the city of Chicago and Cabrini Green have came together that say this will be the last eviction. There will be no eviction. We're against any eviction of poor people in our country and in our city.
So we know from that, but more importantly from our organizing and reaching out to people in different communities, that there are whole buildings sitting empty, right? There's no reason why we shouldn't be getting into those buildings, getting the gas, getting the water turned back on, and getting families back into those homes and restabilizing those communities.
Affordable housing doesn't exist in affluent, opportunity-rich communities. And so to destroy public housing and say, go find a better place, is ludicrous if you haven't provided high-quality, affordable housing in communities that can support families the way that they want to be supported.
This month, local organizations all over the country are taking action as part of the National Take Back the Land movement. Local action groups are educating, organizing, and taking direct action to support families facing eviction, to open empty foreclosed homes for people without housing, to assert the right to occupy vacant government properties and land, and to demand that those forced to leave their longtime communities have the right to return. Tonight on Circle A Radio, we'll hear from some of the groups participating in the national campaign to elevate housing to a human right. We talked with Julie McCurdy from Right to Survive, Keith Sadler from the Toledo Foreclosure Defense League, Holly Krigg of the Chicago Anti-Eviction Campaign, Zee Hawkiness with Operation Welcome Home, Zakia Henderson-Brown from Families United for Racial and Economic Equality, Maiba Liebenthal of Survivors Village, and Steve Meacham from City Life, Vita Urbana. Stay tuned.
On May 1st, Right to Survive kicked off the month of action in Portland, Oregon, with a festival of resistance and a large public campout in defiance of the anti-camping ordinance.
Right to Survive started as the only voice we knew how to have regarding oppression of the homeless. We are for the right to sleep, the right to sit, the right to lie, the right to self-sustain, and we're all about helping and having people help themselves to learn how to stand up as a community, because that's what we are. We're a community. We're not a bunch of bums. We are a community with our strengths and our weaknesses and our own unique challenges, but still we contribute to the community at large. That's what the celebration was about, how we can all fit together in this beautiful city.
My name is Ibrahim Mubarak. I'm a homeless activist that stands up for human rights. I'm one of the co-founders of Dignity Village, and I just formed a new group called R2S, which means Right to Survive. With the economic crunch they have now, anybody are becoming homeless.
The recent May Day action was phenomenal. It was impossibly empowering to see a community stand up and celebrate taking their rights back. We did a tented encampment, and we did that at an abandoned school, which we thought was appropriate because it is public land and it is a vacant building and we were unhoused people doing it. We had Skillshare workshops, which were designed to meet self-sustaining needs for our community, more tailored to us than the city wants to provide, which I felt really good about. I mean, we were able to demonstrate in one day without any funding whatsoever that we can remain autonomous and stand up and be human and contribute to the community as well.
People that live in houses and losing their jobs are not looking outside saying, oh, look at those people down there. They're looking over their shoulder saying, am I next?
Can you tell me about some of the other things Right to Survive has done in the past?
Well, we started out by participating in the San Francisco protest with RAP for housing opportunities for people. Right after that, there were 7 women that had been raped in a week in the unhoused community. So we took immediate action by sending people out with whistles, sending patrols out among our own people. The women didn't want to respond to police because police classically have harassed and brutalized us. So therefore, we didn't ask anyone to be re-victimized. We've done many things in that. We work in conjunction with a whole lot of allies because apparently most people in Portland feel the same as we do, fed up.
This period of time when Cinco de Mayo starts, what does that mean for people who are unhoused in Portland from Cinco de Mayo to the Rose Festival?
Traditionally, Cinco de Mayo and the Rose Festival, what they indicate to the unhoused is that there's going to be further oppression, further brutality, and police sweeps because the city doesn't want the tourists to see unhoused people. That gives the city a bad name, in their opinion. And so what happens is people that have set up encampments are swept out of those encampments and rousted several times during the night and during the day. They're ticketed, oftentimes taken to jail. We're in the middle of organizing some alternatives. Right now, I'm absolutely appalled and horrified at city council's passing this new, yet still unconstitutional, sidewalk management plan. Nick Fish told me directly to my face that it wasn't going to be enforced between the hours of 9 and 7, and yet I'm talking to a lot of people who see that differently. The police have been rousting people for sleeping too close to a building. The sidewalk management plan is not only unconstitutional, it violates human rights and asks unhoused people to sleep on the curb next to cars. I'm not quite sure what the city thinks they're doing here, but pulling the wool over our eyes hasn't been effective so far. I don't think it'll be effective in the future. I think they need to meet with us and seriously consider some alternatives.
If people want to get involved, how do they get in touch with Right to Survive?
We'd love for people to get involved. That is the key to this whole thing. We do have a Facebook, and we have a blog site, and we have a website. On that website and on that blog, we have things people can do to get involved that want to get involved.
That was Julie McCurdy. She writes a column for Street Roots called Diaries of the Disenfranchised, and she's an organizer with Right to Survive. You can email them at r2spdx@gmail.com. That's the numeral 2. Or check out their blog, righttosurvive.wordpress.com. You also heard some audio from a short piece produced by the Bee Media Collective at the May Day encampment and featuring the voice of R2S organizer Ibrahim Mubarak.
Next, we'll go to Toledo, Ohio. According to the statistics released by the Ohio Supreme Court, the statewide foreclosure average is up. Ohio Courts of Common Pleas 2009 statistics report 89,053 new residential and commercial foreclosure case filings. This marked the 14th annual consecutive increase for the state. This is the case all over the country.
My name's Keith Sadler. I live in the Toledo, Ohio area and belong to a group called the Toledo Foreclosure Defense League, which was created out of our October 15th anarchist collective here in the Toledo area. Basically, we had been looking around trying to see what things were in place community-wise to help fight foreclosures and basically found nothing other than the typical mainstream, we'll try to get you a loan modification type stuff. So we felt more was needed. We also were forming to look into putting some homeless folks into vacant homes, but our focus had been mostly on foreclosures, and we started in March of 2009. I basically have lived in a home since 1989 out in Stony Ridge, Ohio, and I had some problems at work. I'm an auto worker, a UAW member, and had to have a couple surgeries on my hand and was not able to return to work. And while I was off for almost a year on disability, my mortgage went into default, as they say. The bank had promised to help me with so some kind of program, and so, you know, went through the loan modification and all that kind of stuff, and basically they pulled the rug out from under me, and in January of last year started foreclosure proceedings on my home. The foreclosure defense league itself had been active. We disrupted sheriff sales in Lucas County, which is the county that Toledo is in. We held public meetings and that type of thing, trying to get people to come forward and help us to help them defend their homes. People are just plain scared of doing anything extra legal. So as time went on, it just came clear that my house would end up being used to make a big spectacle of what's going on with other people. So the end of last year, we started planning on how we were going to barricade the house, how we were going to try to make sure that the message got out to everybody. And in January of this year, my house was sold at sheriff's sale. And as time came closer, I finally got an eviction notice. And that was also our day. May 2nd, we sealed ourselves in my house. There was myself and actually six other people. We had most of the barricades up already. We just did our finishing barricades after we locked ourselves in. We had plenty of food, water. We had communication equipment, two-way radios. We had computers set up for doing live feed out on the internet, and everything just went into place from there. I mean, we ended up getting not only a lot of supporters from around the area coming out, we had people who came and played music on my porch while we were sealed inside. People brought food. We had like a 2-inch hole in the front window that we used to supply electric cables out to the porch. It also became our lifeline, so to speak, for food being smuggled in. People were putting tamales through and burritos, and actually did interviews through this 2-inch hole in the wall. It was really cool how people came together. And we basically did battles through the media and through our broadcast with the sheriff of Wood County, trying to call him out to come and get us. During the time that we were doing the live feeds, we had people supporting us from Sweden, England, New Zealand, Canada, and people from all across the United States. We understand we ended up breaking records on Ustream, which of course was not our intention, but it's just pretty cool how everybody came to support and how this got into everybody's head about this problem. Even finally drew mainstream media into the picture.
The Toledo Foreclosure Defense League is chanting, holding signs, even using technology to get their point across. They want to fight foreclosure here at this Stony Ridge house on Fremont Pike in Wood County, and they are using nonviolent civil disobedience to do it. They say it's their last resort.
We've tried every single possible avenue that the system has sort of set up for us, and they've all failed. We've tried government assistance. We've tried loan remodification. We've tried calling representatives. We've done everything we can, and it's time to sort of step it up and disrupt this process any way we can.
A couple doors down, a neighbor put up a Jolly Roger flag in support of what we were doing and offered to bring truckloads of firewood because people were beginning to camp out in the yard. There was talk about bringing in porta-potties for people to use. That is apparently the reason why the sheriff went ahead and acted when he did, because he felt reinforcements were coming in and he wanted to try to end it. But we held them off because I was supposed to have been evicted on Monday the 3rd, and they didn't come in till the morning of the 7th. So that right there was a little bit of a victory in and of itself.
And while getting in took less time than anticipated, once inside they met another challenge. Five of the seven protesters with their hands in PVC pipe chained together and covered in mortar. So it took some time to break them out of those before deputies had to literally carry them out. Keith Sadler was one of those seven. He lived in the house for 20 years before the bank foreclosed. He appeared in Perrysburg Muni Court via video arraignment this afternoon, charged, like the others, with criminal trespassing and obstructing justice.
Again, this is Keith Sadler.
We had people calling us, calling the bank, calling the sheriff's office from all over. We found that a guy from Florida actually wrote a song inspired by the fight that we were engaged in Stony Ridge. We have a pretrial date scheduled for May 25th. And, of course, we're asking people to come pack the courthouse and also requesting people to withdraw their accounts out of the bank, State Bank and Trust out of Defiance, Ohio. We also have a website now, too. It's called defendtoledo.org. for people to check out what's going on and see what kind of actions we're having, because we're going to be having people call the bank and call the police and call the court. We got the social forum coming up in June that's going to be in Detroit, and a number of people are going to be coming through, converging in Toledo before they go up there. And so we're trying to plan an action around that as well, around the 23rd of June. We're also going to be protesting at the corporate office of the bank that stole my home and has stolen lots of people's homes. And we're hoping this is just a help in sparking, and all these actions are sparking other people to fight back and to do something.
That was Keith Sadler from the Toledo Foreclosure Defense League. Get in touch with them by emailing foreclosuredefenseleague@gmail.com.
Tonight on Circle A Radio, we're talking with autonomous local groups all over the country who are part of the Take Back the Land movement to elevate housing to a human right. Next up, we'll hear from Holly Krieg, an organizer with the Chicago Anti-Eviction Campaign.
My name is Holly Krieg, and I'm a community organizer on the north side of Chicago, mostly in the Uptown and Rogers Park neighborhoods. I've been working to organize a couple of tenants' unions, one in some subsidized housing in an area called North Point, where we have seen a number of wrongful evictions that seem really directly related to the privatization of public housing. There are pending right now through the sheriff's office 3,300 evictions that they're waiting to serve. But that doesn't even count all of the many evictions that are about to go to court, all the people who have received 10-day notices, you haven't started this whole process yet. We've heard from some folks who work around the Daly Center, where the eviction courts are, that there are as many as 35,000 to 40,000 eviction cases that were heard just last year. So it's really terrifying to think about that degree of displacement and where all those folks are supposed to be going. And with subsidized housing in particular, it's terrifying because when you become evicted from subsidized housing, you are then ineligible for future housing subsidy. Basically, if a low-income family living in subsidized housing gets evicted, they have really nowhere to go. Unless they're able to figure out some family that they can stay with, they're likely to end up in some kind of shelter. That's a displacement that's going to affect children who are going to be taken out of their schools. And it's hard to imagine how they're going to figure out how they're going to get back on their feet and pay market rate, whatever that is, in Chicago. But it's more than a lot of people can afford. It's hard not to be thinking about this all the time. But thankfully, we've got some momentum going. We've had a few victories recently, and we've also been able to connect with other great people working around the country doing this kind of work, the Take Back the Land folks in Miami in particular. It was probably last fall, actually, we met someone named Ashraf Kassian through the Take Back the Land folks and some other people working in the Midwest. He's a tenant organizer from Cape Town who came and told us about the kind of work that they've been doing in post-apartheid South Africa, where there is all kinds of eviction happening, the same kind of privatization of public housing that's affected us, and what they've been doing about it in terms of mainly direct actions and organizing tenants to fight back. That certainly inspired us to take more action and to think about different things that we might be able to do in order to keep people in their homes. So that's ranged from having actions at HUD where we demand that they intervene on evictions and to try to hold them accountable even though they are hiding behind these private companies and this outsourcing and this whole process of privatization in public housing, doing human blockades outside of people's apartments from which they've already been foreclosed. We're thinking more about how we can actually reclaim some of the property that is just sitting empty. I think it was the Woodstock Institute came out with some numbers about how many rental units were impacted by foreclosure last year, and it was over 20,000. So we know from that, but more importantly from our organizing and reaching out to people in different communities, that there are whole buildings sitting empty, right? There's no reason why we shouldn't be getting into those buildings, getting the gas, getting the water turned back on, and getting families back into those homes and restabilizing those communities. So there's a lot of different things that we need to be working on. Ultimately, I think we need to all figure out how we can do housing differently in our communities, that they're going to be sustainable communities. This foreclosure crisis, I think, has erupted in a way that has shown people outside of the experience of subsidized housing where evictions have been happening for a long time, that this can happen to anybody. I think we've got to come together around the idea that housing is a human right, And if folks in subsidized housing don't have a right to housing, then folks who are dealing with buying homes and facing foreclosure don't have a right to housing. Nobody has a right to housing unless we all do. Unless we're fighting for that together, we're not going to have any real kind of impact, and we're not going to make any real change around the way that housing is done.
Can you tell us some stories about your recent victories?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Most recently, we were fighting alongside a tenant named Carol Vialdoris, who's also someone I've been working with around the tenant organizing at North Point, which is, again, project-based Section 8 housing, which is owned by a billion-dollar housing conglomerate called AIMCO. They have housing all over the country and in Puerto Rico and are really exploiting tenants all over the country. But with Carol Vialdoris, she's someone who really stood up for herself. There's a lot of exploitation around work orders, forcing tenants to pay for things that they shouldn't have to pay, or simply not making the repairs that they need to make. So Carol Vialdoris had started to speak up and say, you know what, I don't think that that's something I should have to pay for. And if there are things that she did have to pay for, she wanted to negotiate what it was she was going to pay, because there's been a lot of arbitrary fees assessed for various things, and it doesn't seem that they have any real structure. Somebody could be paying $500 for something or $1,000 for something, and sometimes repairs that they shouldn't be expected to pay at all. And keep in mind, these are people who are low income, some of whom are living on Social Security and or raising children. So there are some exorbitant fees. We've seen this with a lot of folks, and that when they've challenged paying for things they shouldn't have to pay or spoken up about things they didn't think were right, that management would find a reason to refuse their rent and give them a 10-day notice. So this happened to Carol Vialdoris. And she decided that she was going to fight back. And because we had already been doing some tenant organizing and had some traction and already had a victory, actually, with a friend of hers, Erica Bledsoe, she reached out and told her neighbors about what was happening to her, and we decided that we were going to create some kind of campaign around this and that we were going to fight with her, because this was happening to far too many people, and her case was similar to what so many other people were experiencing. We got out, we created petitions, we put them online, but more importantly, we just got out in the community. She and her neighbors and the local supporters and folks from the Chicago Anti-Eviction Campaign got out and talked to people and passed these petitions out. We ended up having a big press conference outside HUD in which we demanded that they intervene on this eviction before it went to court. And we actually did, Carol and myself, get to go up and talk to Mr. Ed Hinsberger, who's the director of the multi-hub family housing in Chicago, and say that in as much as in this privatization, AIMCO has direct oversight over this property and is responsible for its care and maintenance, that HUD has to be in some way, in some real way, accountable for people's right to housing. If there are problems with the conditions and if there are things that are threatening that right to housing, they need to step in. So we did get him to agree to set up a meeting with management and to look over their eviction records, their pending evictions, work orders, and to go around and look at some of the property. But we did not get him to agree to intervene on the case, although he is talking now with some other tenants who are facing possible evictions. So we did end up going to court with her. However, we brought a huge group of people. We packed that courtroom in a way that I don't think anyone going through eviction court or the judges or lawyers had ever seen before. We were wearing name tags that all said, "Hello, my name is Carol." They did, on the first day, put us out when they chose the jury, because I think it was so shocking to them and they weren't sure if this was going to be disruptive. But what we found out from Carol and her lawyer, John Elson, that it took them what turned out to be 3.5 hours to choose 6 out of 24 possible jurors, because most people said that they didn't feel comfortable with the idea of putting someone out, which in a way was interesting because we thought this is a theoretically random group of people, right, who share only the fact that they're registered voters. These were black people, white people, men, women, saying that they didn't feel comfortable with it. What concerned us, of course, is does that mean that if you're fine with putting a family out, that you're impartial? We didn't know what that suggested about the jury we were left with. But Carol, walking out of that first day, having seen all of her supporters in the room, having seen so many jurors say that they didn't want to be a part of putting her out, said, "I feel loved." And that was tremendous. It's hard to imagine how incredibly stressful this is to be facing the loss of your home and the home in which you're raising 4 children. We continued then over the next couple of days to bring folks into the courtroom and to pack the courtroom. I think it was intimidating to management, the plaintiff, AIMCO, trying to put her out. They had 4 people testify against her: a property manager, the assistant manager, security officer, and a custodial worker. And all of them directly contradicted statements that they had made in their depositions. That was very interesting, and it seemed so clear that they were trying to contrive allegations in order to justify putting this woman and her children out. And the only possible explanation to us is that this is a woman who stood up and fought for herself. Then the third and final day, she testified herself, and she was amazing. We were worried for her. I mean, it's such an incredibly intimidating situation. Eviction is so extreme. Being in eviction court, it's a terrifying experience for most people, but she's a strong person. You know, she's been living at North Point 16 years, so she's used to having to stand up and fight back in some way. We didn't know what was going to happen when the jury went out to reach its verdict, and it was scary for a lot of us. And what's very interesting, and as I'm hearing from lawyers I'm talking with and other people who've been involved in this process, in an unprecedented move, the judge actually addressed us as witnesses and asked us what our interest in this case was, because he was surprised to see us come back every day. And we explained to him that we wanted to be able to show Carol support because she and so many people who live in AIMCO housing are being wrongfully evicted. And we also want to make it clear that we think that this is extreme, that eviction is so devastating, and there should be some kind of recourse that tenants have. There should be some mediation that is compulsory on both sides. So he actually listened to what we said, and it was nice because we also had the chance to offer some more information about what some of the other issues were. Now, North Point's lawyer got very upset, and she tried to stop it by saying, I think the jury can hear this, and the judge said, no, they can't possibly hear, they're in several rooms away, and et cetera. But he made the statement that his feeling after all these years was that there's plenty of food and housing in this country. We should be able to arrive at a point where everybody actually has access to that food and that housing. So what we're hoping is that we're continuing to build momentum from this, that becomes, in the short term, a demand for a moratorium on all economically motivated evictions with the broadest possible definition of that. Beyond that, we figure out how we're going to do housing differently, what kind of mechanisms are in place that really upset this balance of power so that people from the community might come together and maybe we can put something together that would be like a tenants' rights board, and that tenants' stories can really be heard and better understood, and that we can keep people in their homes. Because if housing is a human right, there's got to be some real concrete mechanisms in place to ensure that. And people have to also be willing to come out and be ready to fight for it. And that's what we're seeing, and that's what's amazing. What's most encouraging and inspiring is seeing how the tenants are coming together to organize. This has to be about local organizing around stabilizing local communities and people coming out in support of one another. We have certainly seen that around North Point. I need to say that as much as we came together in support of a woman, a single mother with no other options, and as much as we did what we could to save her home, we also saved the home of somebody who is a tremendous community organizer herself. This whole process has taken someone who already had some commitments to her community and turned her into someone who is on fire, who is going to be fighting, I think, for a long time for housing rights for people in her community. And I hope that we see a whole lot more of that. Insofar as local communities coming together then on a citywide basis so that we can collaborate and work together and support one another, the Chicago Anti-Eviction Campaign is certainly trying to pull that together and coordinate that. People can find us at chicagoantieviction.org. We also will be posting an event that we're calling a People's Assembly in advance of the U.S. Social Forum, in which we're going to bring a whole bunch of groups together and individuals to talk about what they're experiencing and what they'd like to do and how we can work together, how we can bring that to the U.S. Social Forum and learn more from people doing this kind of work around the country, and then come back and do some real solid direct action and fight on the ground for the housing that is ours and we have a right to.
That was Holly Craig of the Chicago Anti-Eviction Campaign. This is Circle A Radio on KBOO 90.7 in Portland. Tonight, we're bringing you interviews from organizers across the country who are part of a movement for community control over land and housing. Next up, Zee Hawkiness from Operation Welcome Home in Madison, Wisconsin.
My name is Zee Hawkiness, and I work with Operation Welcome Home as an ally in the organization. Operation Welcome Home is Homeless Fighting for the Homeless. It's a group of predominantly African-American men and increasingly more African-American women organizing around the root causes of homelessness along with allies. Operation Welcome Home started in Brittingham Park. It was a park where predominantly African-American community was spending time. A lot of people were living there in the park. A lot of people were getting harassed at the shelter, and so they were staying there at the park. And a transgender woman had died there in the park. There was big backlash from the predominantly white neighbors next to the park, so there was a big community response, and the mayor had gotten involved and city officials trying to lock down the park and keep people out of the park. That was our first campaign to try to work to ensure that people had a right to public space. The police harassment increased and people were displaced to another park called Peace Park. Once again, there was a campaign to displace people, a campaign by the city to try to revitalize the park. You know, they were gentrifying this part of the neighborhood and trying to kick homeless people out and people of color out of the park. That was our second campaign, once again, around public space and around looking for alternatives to displacing homeless people around the city and looking for real solutions to the root causes of homelessness, looking for a community center for people to go, looking for employment for people and affordable housing for people. We've gotten involved with Take Back the Land as our main campaign starting in the fall of this year, and it's been really exciting to be involved. A lot of people in Madison have been really energized by the campaign. It's brought us up to just most recently is when we did our first major action. We did our first housing liberation. We had met Desiree Wilson. She's a friend of some of the people in the organization, and she was homeless and doubled up in her family's house with her two children and cramped for space, and so she wanted to find something better for her situation, and she was excited about moving into a foreclosed property that we had found. She's been a really strong leader throughout the last month in that process and has been really trying to improve her own situation, but knowing that she's part of something bigger, that she's part of the broader Take Back the Land movement. So she moved in, and she was there for a few weeks. So we wanted to keep quiet with the situation, but there was some police contact, so we decided to go public and to spread the word about what we were doing, spread the word about our message that housing is a human right, and spread the word about the national movement that we're part of. This month is the May Month of Action as kickoff to the National Take Back the Land movement, and so we wanted to highlight the foreclosure and housing crisis in Madison and the homeless situation. So we went public with the situation, and soon after the police requested that Desiree leave from the property, we moved out right away, and she has moved back with her family, and she has gotten some calls from supporters offering to rent to her. She's working, and she's ready to pay rent, ready to move into another place, but she's just had trouble finding something that's affordable. And, you know, one of the things that we were working on through the campaign was to highlight that Bank of America has the lien on the property. We were targeting Bank of America, saying that they had gotten $45 billion in bailout money, and they were also taking ownership over this property. And so what we were asking was that the property be turned over to the Madison Area Community Land Trust, and we had been working with the Madison Area Community Land Trust, and if the property would have been able to be turned over to them, then we would have been able to find a way to create a system for Desiree to pay an affordable rent or possibly work to pay a lease or purchase the house.
What's your take on the media coverage of what happened in Madison?
The media really grabbed onto it and really went with the story. They said that it was the biggest story that they've had this year in the media.
Even the organizers behind this local movement that's made its way to Madison say they agree this is illegal, but they say they are challenging the law based on morals. That housing, they claim, is a basic human need. And they say banks who own the foreclosed properties own them because of the financial bailout package.
We feel that housing is a human right. We don't feel like we're breaking the law.
2 weeks ago, Desiree Wilson and representatives from Operation Welcome Home entered this property on Madison's west side.
There's three bedrooms instead of one. The kids are able to get up and move around freely, play with their toys.
The property is going through foreclosure. The bank sale is next week. It has sat vacant for at least a year. Operation Welcome Home says they're starting a movement to get more people off the streets into homes like this one.
We feel that it's unjust and immoral that there's homeless people on one side of the street and empty buildings on the other side of the street.
It's modern-day squatting, taking up residence in a vacant property without permission. Again, this property is going through the foreclosure process. The current owner could not be located today. Law enforcement tells News 3 they really can't get involved unless the owner files a trespassing complaint.
Well, you mentioned earlier, this isn't really an event. Mm-hmm. This is more of a movement.
It's a movement that they really hope takes off fully. They're actually encouraging other homeless individuals to follow their lead, and they say they will continue to look for properties here in the Madison area to find homes for those who currently do not have one.
I think that made people in Madison take a stance on the issue and to really think about the situation that people are facing. Once again, this house is going to be sitting empty for another year, possibly 2 years. It's already been sitting empty for a year or 2 years. Another family is without a home. I think that people are really being forced to look at it. The Dane County Housing Authority came out saying that she is in support of this. She understands the situation. There's a really high lack of affordable housing, that the Section 8 lists have been closed off for too long. There's a huge waiting list for Section 8 and affordable housing in Madison. So I feel like there's been a great response. There's been a lot of people calling us saying that they're homeless and that they're looking for a place to stay. And it's brought up a lot of classism and racism. That was one of the reasons that there was trouble with this house, was because of neighbors complaining about the situation. And it's really difficult because we really worked hard to talk with the neighbors and to try to help them understand the situation. But a lot of it came down to racism and this idea of individualism and pull yourself up by the bootstraps. And we work hard, so why can't everybody else? It's just too bad that there's that kind of divide and conquer strategy has seeped into the neighborhoods and into our community by the banks, who like to keep people fighting like that while they continue to make these enormous profits and act irresponsibly with people's money and people's lives.
That was Zee Hockiness with Operation Welcome Home in Madison, Wisconsin. Since talking with Zee last week, Operation Welcome Home has launched another action, this time drawing attention to Freddie Mac, recipient of about $145 billion of bailout money from the federal government. Here's an NBC local news report from Madison.
Now at 6, they're back. A local group has not given up on putting homeless families into foreclosed homes. Good evening, I'm John Stofflett.
And I'm Dana Bruick. Lee is off tonight. Volunteers for Take Back the Land decided to do a little spring cleaning today at the next property they plan on occupying.
It comes a week after squatters were evicted from a different home. NBC 15's Zach Schultz has the story.
Housing is a human right!
Housing is a human right!
Chanting all the way, the group Take Back the Land led the media and police on a parade to the next home they plan to occupy, this time on Turbot Drive on Madison's south side.
That's why we stand and fight!
Their mission is to put homeless families into foreclosed properties, focusing on homes owned by large banks that took federal bailout money.
We are here to ask the Madison Police Department and the Dane County Sheriff's Office to protect families instead of corporate bailed out banks.
We all need...
Take Back the Land and Operation Welcome Home gained attention last week when they announced they had moved a woman and her two kids into a duplex on the southwest side. But that home was not foreclosed yet, and the owner asked police to evict them. This home was foreclosed on last October and is owned by Freddie Mac.
This is not Fannie Mae's house. This is not Freddie Mac's house. This is public housing. It should be used as public housing.
Housing is a human right.
Robert McGee used to live on the left side. He was forced to move out last July.
It was in nice, beautiful shape. Now, the house went up under foreclosure last year, which forced us to go to another place. Now the house is being vandalized. People, real squatters, are squatting in there, vandalizing the house.
The group walked in through a broken back door and are now cleaning it up. but they won't say for whom.
We at this point have families that are interested in finding housing. We don't have anybody that's specifically looking for this one right now.
Madison police were on hand, but only to observe. They know the group members are there illegally, but cannot do anything until the owner complains.
Why take back the land?
Of course, they won't call a press conference every time they illegally move a family into an empty home, and one group member says it's probably already happened.
That's something that we're working on, but we're not going to comment on that at this moment.
Housing is a human right!
Zach Schultz, NBC 15 News.
More information is available at operationwelcomehome.wordpress.com.
You are listening to Circle A Radio on KABU. Our guests tonight belong to autonomous local organizations who are participants in the national Take Back the Land movement, a movement which focuses on empowering the most impacted communities, especially low-income communities of color. Our next guest is Zakiya Henderson Brown from FURY, Families United for Racial and Economic Equality.
My name is Zakiya Henderson Brown. I'm a staff organizer at Families United for Racial and Economic Equality, a member-led community-based organization that does work around economic justice. Most of our campaign work at this point is centered around food justice, around restoring access to healthy and affordable food in the neighborhood, which is a very quickly gentrifying neighborhood in downtown Brooklyn and part of Fort Greene. Also around ensuring that there is going to be sufficient affordable housing given the gentrification.
We asked Zakiya about FURY's relationship with the National Take Back the Land movement.
We're a national partner, which functionally means that we believe in the vision of Take Back the Land. We believe that housing is a human right and that everyone, especially in communities of color and historically disenfranchised communities, that we deserve housing and we have a right to it. And so we support the takeovers and the housing defenses, and ultimately, at some point later on in the year, we will be endeavoring to do the same thing.
Can you talk about some of the actions and campaigns, strategies that you've been using?
We focus on organizing, right? So we're a community organizing organization, and so our primary goal is to shift the dynamic of power via our members. So we want to support our members in the developing of their leadership skills and their empowerment to that end. So we focus on organizing, but we also figure out how to leverage our targets. So we have targets for most of our campaigns. In the food justice campaign, it's a developer who took away a supermarket that was the primary source of healthy, affordable food in the neighborhood. It was directly across the street from public housing where most of our members are from. He's one of our targets, right? We've been trying to meet with him. We've figured out different ways to campaign against him, to complain to him, to figure out how to get elected officials on our side. We do actions to increase visibility around our issues. Actions could be anything from rallies at City Hall, marches through the neighborhood, stage press events, that sort of thing. But mostly, I mean, the bulk of our work is around getting the people in the community on board, right? We feel like we're most powerful when we have our community behind us.
And how long has FURY been organizing?
FURY is a fairly young organization. We started about 10 years ago. It was a welfare rights organization at that point in 2001. Some of the other things we're doing, we're trying to restore supermarkets to Myrtle Avenue, which is a main strip in downtown Brooklyn. We're trying to restore supermarkets that are going to maintain fresh food. We have a problem with food quality in the neighborhood, but also it doesn't mean that we need a luxury supermarket that people who've lived in public housing for 50 years can't afford because they're trying to make it amenable to the people moving into the condos that are recently put up, right? So that's one struggle, but a different piece of our food justice campaign is figuring out what sustainable alternatives are so we don't have to rely on campaigning against a developer who will never have our interests in mind when he builds, because it's all about money, right? We helped to start a community-supported agriculture group, a CSA, where our members get access to fresh food. They buy into it, and they get access to fresh food. We've been in talks with a group of people who are starting a food co-op in the neighborhood and figuring out how we can get our members involved in that process on the front end. So it's not only campaigning against the big developers and the people who have historically held power, but it's also figuring out what alternatives are. I mean, not only around the food justice stuff that I assume is happening all over the country and in our communities, but with housing. I mean, it is completely absurd that public housing is at risk nationally. And not only is it at risk, the new commissioner of New York City Public Housing, John Rhea, we're campaigning against because their plan for New York City is to make public housing into mixed-income housing. Now, mixed-income housing alone, there's absolutely nothing wrong with it, right? It's fine to mix it up. Mix of classes, and maybe that's good, and maybe that's more sustainable. But you cannot get rid of affordable housing units that people rely on because they make less than $20,000 a year and not replace them, right? And that's really where the housing crisis part comes into play, especially with regard to the work that we're doing in Fury. A lot of our members are from public housing, and they are trying to destroy public housing, and specifically in New York City. New York City has the largest number of units of public housing in the entire country. And so it will effectively displace the largest number of people if they make those types of changes to public housing, which is what they're trying to do. To bring it back to the Take Back the Land, housing is absolutely a human right, and it's something that we have to fight for, because everything that happens in cities in particular has to do with money, right? What's the most profitable thing? What's the most cost-effective thing? When it comes to people's housing, when it comes to families who need affordable housing, that can't be the driving force.
Would you like to give out some information, like your website, so people who hear this can go on and learn more about what Fury does?
Yes, the Fury website is fury.org, F-U-R-E-E.org. Thanks for having me. I love this whole idea of just people doing good work, people doing activism across the country, being in touch, right? Because I think we need to be doing more of that.
You just heard staff organizer Zakiya Henderson-Brown with Fury in New York City. That's Families United for Racial and Economic Equality.
Next up on Circle A Radio, we talked with Maiba Liebenthal in New Orleans, who is an organizer for the Survivors Village Right to Return Weekend, kicking off on May 28th.
So my name is Maiba. I'm currently working with Survivors Village, helping with this weekend of housing as a human right and the weekend for a right of return. I feel like I've been brought into the housing movement as part of the other work that I do, seeing housing as a really important part of that. That includes ending violence against women of color, as well as abolishing the prison industrial complex, just a general overall justice issue. And when you think about violence against women, there are so many ways that housing, affordable housing, and public housing affects women. We saw, after Katrina, an 80% drop in female head of household. It's almost like, well, who is being targeted? In part, that is because of the fact that people were not allowed to get back into these particular properties. It's also because they focused more on rebuilding the tourist industry and the tourist economy and markets instead of neighborhoods, so people with children or who were caregivers in any way, shape, or form couldn't return to the city. Just to think about the fact that, like, the city was not accommodating to women, period, is one way to look at it, as well as just thinking about when you have broken communities, when you have a lack of affordable housing, when you have people staying with people who they don't necessarily know very well, or in highly stressful situations, such as the trailers that people were staying in. They weren't really trailers, they were campers, they were tiny. You're increasing people's stress factor, and it increases domestic violence as well. This is more of like a right to return issue instead of just thinking about it in terms of just housing. But this probably connects more the PIC and the right of return. But the communities that were being patrolled and still are being patrolled by, at the time, the National Guard for several years, and also the police, are poor communities of color. And so it's just a general environment of harassment and intimidation that people have to deal with, which is not necessarily very welcoming. So while I'm working with Survivors Village on this particular campaign, I see it as something that is really important for the movement to focus in general, especially in New Orleans, where so many people are still displaced and affordable housing is still hard to find. Survivors Village started as a tent city back in 2006 by former residents of public housing, as well as just people who were residents of other developments as well. And they started a tent city outside of City Hall. I was personally not involved at this point in time. So they did this tent city, and it got a lot of support, and a lot of homeless people started coming to the tent city. And eventually what the city did was they kicked everyone off and then fenced off the land in front of City Hall for about 2 to 3 years. And that's been the general response to anybody who's been doing any sort of direct action or visibility around the problem of homelessness and around the problem of displacement in the city of New Orleans, is that it's been abrupt shutdown by the city. I got more involved back in 2007 around the Coalition to Stop the Demolition, where Survivors Village was one of the organizations that was a part of a citywide movement to stop the demolition of public housing. That all ended with people being arrested, beaten, and tased, and dragged out of City Hall, and all of the housing developments being demolished except for Iberville Housing Development, which is still there, but I think people are looking at it to see that's on the chopping block. There were seven before, and now there's one.
Because they're demolishing and have demolished most of those places that people called home, can you talk about the right to return and how you address the fact that their houses, they're now gone?
It looks like now the focus is less on public housing, even though the people who currently live in public housing still have a right to live there. It's about trying to get people back home into these new developments that have been rebuilt, and they promised that people would be able to move back in. The problem is, though, if they're using the Hope 6 model to redevelop, like Hope 6 mixed income model to redevelop these neighborhoods, so only a certain percentage, a very small percentage of people who previously lived there are actually able to move back in. There's that one particular inequity, as well as for people who are looking for rent in the city. I think it's important for people to know and realize that getting rid of public housing and also having a lot of vacant buildings and empty buildings affects our market rate. Renters, because it was a public housing thing before, didn't really see themselves as part of this struggle, but it very much is. It's important for us to stand in solidarity for people's right of return to live back in those buildings or live back in the city of New Orleans or be able to develop the vacant land that is still sitting there. It's up to renters to see themselves as part of that struggle and to stand in solidarity with it as well.
What are you involved in organizing for the weekend of the 22nd?
Currently, I think the biggest campaign that former residents get into the Columbia Park housing development. That day is going to be really set aside to bring awareness to the fact that people are not getting into the list, as well as the fact that the market rate value is far too high for most average New Orleanians, and getting people into the buildings as part of their right of return and part of their human right to housing.
What do you want people on this coast to know about what's happening in New Orleans?
One of the things is paying attention and also myth-busting. There are reports out there that the population is back to 3/4 of what it was before. Even though the population is back, this isn't the same people who were here before. People are just approaching life here in a different way, and it's changing the way that the city operates, and people are still fighting for their right to return. I can say now what I said 5 years ago, which is that, you know, Katrina was just a microcosm of the issues that are facing any urban center in this country right now. Detroit has the same problems that New Orleans does, and there wasn't a quote-unquote natural disaster, because really it wasn't about the hurricane, it was when the levees broke. So these are the same issues of displacement and gentrification and policing and militarization that happen everywhere. So keep that in mind, that all around the country, in your own homes and towns and in your backyard, Katrina is happening as well. And to pay attention to that as much as you do pay attention to what's going on in New Orleans.
That was Maiba Liebenthal, an organizer for Survivors Village Right to Return Weekend. We'll be wrapping up tonight's show with a short interview with tenant organizer Steve Meacham of City Life, Vita Urbana in Boston.
My name is Steve Meacham, and I'm an organizer at City Life, Vita Urbana. City Life's been around about 37 years and working on many different issues, but focused on questions of forced displacement. For most of that time, we've been doing a lot of tenant organizing, and in particular, in the last decade, been doing tenant organizing in big buildings, much like unions do, and achieving collective bargaining agreements with real estate firms, agreements that set the rents over the 3 to 5 year period, very much like a labor union sets wages. And so we had about 1,000 units under contract like that. When the foreclosure crisis hit about 3 years ago, we initially didn't think that it was an issue that we could get involved in because it was mostly individualized homeowner counseling. But then we realized that the banks had become the biggest evicting agents, and so we began to organize both tenants and former homeowners in foreclosed buildings as tenants of the bank and trying to fight their evictions, and discovered that that achieved a lot of leverage that the traditional loan modification counseling didn't have. We call it the Bank Tenants Association, and it's grown quite large now. It's about every week we have meetings of maybe 125 people or more.
You have been able to, in some cases, reverse foreclosures.
Well, in order to stop the evictions, we have done everything. We have a strategy we call the sword and the shield, where the shield is legal defense and the sword is public protest and public pressure. By utilizing both things, getting people really well-versed in what their legal rights are, but also being willing to protest in front of banks or in front of people's homes, up to and including eviction blockades where we risk arrest in order to stop evictions. By using all those tactics, we've managed to stop 90% of the evictions of people who reach our organization, which is hundreds of people. And then once we stop the eviction, we propose to the banks that a nonprofit intermediary can buy the building and sell it back to the occupants. And so we're able to get people's homes back at maybe half of loan value oftentimes.
How is it that you're tied into the National Month of Action that Take Back the Land has been coordinating?
Well, we had followed and heard about what Take Back the Land was doing in Miami. It was a little bit different in the sense that Take Back the Land was really focused on occupying vacant property. And we were really focused on defending people from being evicted and creating vacant property. But naturally, there was quite an overlap, too. When this month was announced, we certainly felt like it was in our interest to participate. We have almost weekly rallies of one kind or another, so our contribution in May was just sort of what happened to come up in May, if you know what I mean. This Thursday, we're doing a big protest downtown in front of JPMorgan Chase, which announced record profits in the first quarter of this year and also announced that they refused to participate with Obama in reducing principal under the new loan modification program. So for all those reasons, they're the right target. And we have a lot of cases of people who have actually offered to buy their homes back at fair market value and Chase won't negotiate. So that's the action we're doing this week. Another part of our strategy is to do something that we call block rebellions, where we try to get banks that own foreclosed property in a contiguous area. We make a demand on all the banks that own property in that area to sell the property. It's in that context that we've at times occupied vacant property more in line with what Take Back the Land is doing. And we're hoping to do something like that next month. You have these national debates going on and the national news reports about what the banks are doing. But to be able to address those things through local organizing in one street is really quite a remarkable thing for an organizer. There's these seemingly untouchable giant institutions you can really confront and beat in a local arena.
You have been listening to Circle A Radio. We'd like to thank all our guests, Julie McCurdy from Right to Survive, Keith Sadler of the Toledo Foreclosure Defense League, Holly Craig from the Chicago Anti-Eviction Campaign, Zee Hockiness with Operation Welcome Home, Zakiya Henderson-Brown from Families United for Racial and Economic Equality, FURY, Maiba Liebenthal, organizing with Survivors Village, and Steve Meacham from City Life, Vida Urbana. These are just some of the local action groups taking part in the May 2010 Take Back the Land Month of Action. Find out more about the movement and autonomous local organizations who are working to assert the human right to housing by checking out takebacktheland.org.
Circle A Radio comes to you each first and third Wednesday of the month on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 in Portland.
Our next show will be hosted by the Roosevelt Rough Riders Oral History Project. They'll be on the air from 6 to 7 p.m.
We love hearing from you. Send us your comments by emailing circlearadio@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.